Go live. Good morning. Yes, live. Rushing. What always end up rushing? I've got too much stuff on. I woke up at three something this morning, thinking about things. Think about Stefan. There he is. He's in the chat. We'll talk about that because we're going to get in and talk about some of the Have I Been Pwned things in just a moment. But you ever do this? Like, do you just wake up in the middle of, well, not the middle of the night, but very early in the day with something on your brain? And anyway, I think we solved some problems at three something in the morning. All right, let's do the sponsor bit first. We'll do that. And then I think I'm going to wing it a little bit. I do have an agenda, I do have a list, but there is some other stuff there. Bruce is here. Good morning, Bruce. And Stefan, of course. Joe is in UK from memory. Good evening, Joe. Sponsor, Collide. Collide again. Collide ensures that if a device isn't secure, you can't access your apps. It's device trust for Okta. Watch the demo today. Now, I think it was last week I mentioned I'd just seen that Collide has become a part of the 1Password family. I've still not heard any more about that. I'd love to know a little bit more about it because it is fascinating given my strongly vested interest in 1Password as well. Until then, it is on-demand demo time from Collide, device trust for Okta. In the demo, you see the challenges of implementing device trust with Okta, how Collide integrates with Okta to keep untrusted devices from accessing your company's apps, and how end-user remediation removes the IT bottleneck that often derails zero-trust initiatives. So massive thanks to Collide. I'm quite sure by now that they have been probably my most prevalent sponsor. I hope with 1Password as well, they continue. I might just bundle it all in because it seems that there's a lot of good common crossover there. All righty. Where'd I put it? What are we doing? I literally just have to go to Twitter the whole time to figure out what are the things that I've mentioned. Actually, here's a good one to begin with. Easy one. German government. So, when I say the German government, welcome to Have I Been Pwned, that doesn't mean the German government has been breached. And congratulations, your data is now in the pwned thing. It's not that at all. Germany has now become the 35th national government to get free and open and unmanually verified access to all of their government domains. That's just government domains. Just like all the other ones before it, including the UK and Australia, which of course were the first two to do this back in, I want to say 2018, they will be able to do on-demand queries of APIs for all of their gov things. Now, this is part of Cert Bund. Tell me if I've said that wrong. Cert Bund, something like that. So they get to do domain searches for those domains. And literally, I mean, I think it would end up being something like star.bund.de. And in just the same way as we've got star.gov.au or star.gov.uk. Someone did ask me, I think they asked me on Mastodon today. There are some people. There are some people on Mastodon. Someone asked me, well, you know, is it just that simple? And I was like, yeah, it's mostly TLDs. And some governments only have non-constant TLD domains. They might have been the Spanish one, where it's like whatever, you know, dot es, but it's not like dot gov.es. Australia has some cases like that. Our CSIRO, our scientific research body, is, I think, on CSIRO.au or something like that. So that just gets added to an allow list. So it's a combination of like regex and explicit domain name. So that hopefully makes things easier for those folks to be able to go through and find their government people that are exposed in data breaches. I hear that's been very useful for people. I was actually checking out, I wrote this blog post, was it Troy Hunt, Setting the Bar. Some years ago, I had two separate governments. How do we say this? Let's say of questionable repute. I think, obviously, can't say who they are now. But I think for all of us, there would be countries that you would hear of and you'd go, oh, yeah, that's probably an interesting place I don't want to go. You know, like if I go there, I might disappear. Or I think that they have a very different a different view of the world around everything from women to sexuality to religion to whatever else it may be. That was probably not consistent with most of us here. And I was trying to figure out what is the measure I apply. Like, I think if I was to put one of these governments on have a written announcement message, I'd get a lot of upset people. So what's the measure? So 4 years ago now, almost to the day, 11th of March, 2022, I wrote a blog post called Setting the Bar for Government Access, to Have I Been Pwned. Now, in that, I found a democracy index from memory, the World Population Review website, the democracy ranking by country. And this is not a perfect science. But it ranks from the most democratic to the least democratic based on the electoral process, function of government, political practices, political culture, civil liberties, the most democratic through the least democratic. Now, it aligned very well with my gut feel, and I suspect for most people here, their gut feels, of the good ones and the bad ones. Like, let's be that blunt. The number one at the top of the list is Norway, which obviously I have a very vested interest in. But you're like, just to go through the top group here, and all of these are on Have I Been Pwned Too. Norway, Iceland, representing Stefan, good work. Norway, Iceland, Sweden, New Zealand, Canada, Finland, Denmark, Ireland, Netherlands, Australia. And every single one of those was a government, I think at the time, already on Have I Been Pwned. The next one's Taiwan. Contentious in some parts of the world, they're not. But then after that, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Germany, Uruguay, United Kingdom, all have a Ben Pwned. Now, to put it in context, the other end of the list, dead last, North Korea. Now, can you imagine? I put out a tweet one day. Hey, I'd like to welcome the North Korean government to have a Ben. It's not going to happen. Working backwards, North Korea, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Syria, Chad, Turkmenistan. Yeah, these are all in the realm of countries that probably don't pass the pub test. Google that if you're not familiar with the term. So anyway, it's quite nice to be able to sort of fill out the top with the good ones. So Germany was one of the gaps. We've filled that in. There is another one next week that I'll be announcing, but I kind of want to pace it a little bit. Actually, speaking next week, because I'm looking at the list here. So, yeah, we had Germany, Uruguay, United Kingdom, Chile, Costa Rica, don't have yet. Austria do have. Mauritius don't have. The next one after that is Japan. Next week, I will be coming to you from Japan, which I'm really excited about. Now, that's going to be a really good trip. I used to go to Japan a lot, mostly because my father spent years and years as a pilot working in Japan, and we get cheap flights and everything else. So did that. I haven't been there, I think, for probably 15 years. Charlotte has never been there. So we're going to be off to Japan next week. So I'll be doing this one next week from somewhere in Tokyo. I don't know that I have a lucrative Japanese audience, but if you listen to this and you're from the Japanese government and you want to come on board, you know, like, now's the time. Fill in that top list. Stefan says, as I was trying to find stuff, having problems finding all the things on your super wide monitor. No, on my super wide monitor and the other two wide monitors. The mouse does get lost on occasion. Stefan's also saying Japan's on my bucket list of countries to visit. So Japan's really cool for a number of different reasons. I feel like I've seen a lot of Asia and spent a few years living in Asia, and I think you can go from Singapore to Hong Kong to Shanghai, at least. Beijing's a little bit different in China, to Bangkok to Kuala Lumpur. And a lot of the stuff is different but similar, right? It's like it feels a little bit the same. A lot of similarities in the culture, a lot of similarities in the food. And then you go to Japan and suddenly, like, everything is different. It just feels like a completely different world. It's just like, I haven't been to Iceland yet, as you know, Stefan, we might fix that soon. But it's like if you went from, like, Iceland to, you know, let's say anywhere else in Asia, it feels like a massive difference. It's the same with Japan. It's just very, very different. Massive, massive, massive ginormous city in Tokyo. Food, epic. Love Japanese food. So I'm really, really looking forward to that, as well as a bunch of the cultural stuff. I think it's going to be a really cool trip. So anyway, more on that next week from Tokyo. Now, where was it on that big list? Right, let's talk about some data breaches. What Labs? Now, I had never heard of What Labs. What is it? What was it? It's still a thing. Back to Twitter. Have I been playing? It was like World of Tank Warfare game or something like that. What Labs? Here we go. Oh, yeah. No, this was unpleasant for them. So they got very pwned. 22,000 records. Not massive. It appears to be from a forum. email, IP address, username, date of birth, time zone, no passwords, not even MD5 passwords. But they got defaced, and I'll link through to an archive.org link that shows what they looked like at the time of loading the breach. There's a broken image there. I'm not sure if that's just archive.org or if hackers can't embed images properly. And just some text under it. Chromebook breaches on top. All data has been pwned. Weird nod. Will be leaked soon, and of course it was. They disclosed, I think from memory, in a Telegram channel somewhere, and I got a screen grab of the Telegram channel. So disclosure certainly is much easier, or rather loading it and having been pwned is much easier when there's been disclosure and no one's getting surprised by it. I continue to lament how difficult it can be to get some organizations to disclose. And I feel that there's going to be a good story about this later on. Not related to that website, something totally different. And we'll talk about that another time. Nick 007 is in cloudy Melbourne. It's a little bit cloudy in Gold Coast today too. First day, we're like, it feels like we're about to exit summer. Now, I say this as it's 23 Celsius at 8 something in the morning. But just that little bit. And of course, we get to Tokyo next week, and it will well and truly feel like we've exited summer. Now, the next one here, Russian e-commerce website, online trade. 3.8 million records from 2022. I'll come back to that. Data included email and IP address, name, phone, date of birth, MD5, password hashes. 74% of all of those already have been pwned. Now, why have we put in such an old data breach? I'm glad you asked. Fine. I have a very solid backlog of various incidents. Very solid. And if I'm honest, I honestly don't know how many. Like, I just know there's a lot. And they're no longer time critical. They're, in many cases, you know, like a, let's face it, Russia is not a massive demographic for have I been pwned. The time criticality of this is not particularly high. So as time permits, I'm going back through the backlog and filling in the gaps. I don't think there'll ever be an end to it because there's more and more stuff going in there the whole time as well. One of the things that doing that has been really useful for is as we make changes to have I been pwned, and this is going to lead us neatly into the work that Steph and I have been doing with the database rollover, it allows us to, without time pressure, take a new data breach, go through the load process, and look at things like timings. So this is probably a good point, Stefan, to explain our pain of the last few weeks. Leads us into the next section. Online Russian forum is done. Let's talk about this database rollover. So I mentioned before, we're moving from Azure Table Storage, which was great. It was very, very cheap, still very, very cheap, still very, very fast. And it was an awesome way of standing up Have I Been Pwned as a pet project and then letting it incrementally grow. But Azure Table Storage has some major problems that have got nothing to do with price or performance and everything to do with resiliency and our ability to recover if we have any issues. And what I mean by that is, a really good example, there's no backup strategy. There is no restore from backup for Azure Table Storage. There is no backup for Azure Table Storage. So the only option you've got is you've got to go and run AZ copy and dump everything to either a massive JSON file or a massive CSV file. Now, for have I been pwned, where Stefan says, turns out having tons of data integrity is expensive. Yeah, we're going to get to that. So for have I been pwned, the headline figure on the front page is, what are we at? Nearly 13 billion records. So at the moment, it says 12,985,000,000. Let's call it 13, just for sake of simplicity. Now, that is the number of times an email address has appeared in a data breach. And some of them are phone numbers and usernames. For the most part, it's email addresses in a data breach. The average email address has appeared 2.1 something times. There's actually about 5.5 billion unique email addresses. So remember these two numbers. We've got 5.5 billion email addresses that have appeared a total of 13 billion times. For table storage, there are 5.5 billion rows. And the row is defined by both a partition and a row key. The partition key is the domain part of an email address. The row key is the alias part. So there is a very small partition called troyhunt.com and a couple of rows. And then for each row, which is each unique email address, there's then we called it just added a column called websites, and there's a semicolon delimited list of each data breach it's been in. So for example, for my old classic Hotmail address, I think I'm in 35 data breaches. So there's this massive Hotmail partition, there's one row which is me, and then there's a column called websites with 35 different entries in there. So it's a very sort of flat, denormalized structure. Now, that's what we're coming from. What we really need is we need a combination of a backup strategy. That's not just me running AZ copy randomly and downloading some files for backup. We really need things like point in time restore. So what happens if we want to, if we screw something up? You know, it happens. Or there's data corruption or integrity issues or something. We need to roll back. Definitely need that. We'd really like to start opening the door to options like geo-replication, for example. Maybe we have a hot copy and a cold copy somewhere. Maybe we put one in the EU because there's later on requirements to do things that are, you know, safe harbored within the same jurisdiction. We get all of these options in a much more enterprise-y database model like SQL Server. So the goal has been to roll over to that, and it's made sense, or more sense, more recently because we've got serverless SQL Azure. And it has all the same promises as serverless functions and serverless Cloudflare workers and everything else, which is that we abstract ourselves away from the scale of the underlying hardware and we pay per executions. Look, very roughly speaking, there's still servers. You still need to define some sort of scope and size. But it moves us in that direction. Now, just as a bit of an example here, during the week, I cocked something up in the database. Not in a way that impacted anyone, that, you know, no one would have noticed, but I had to do a point in time restore. And I could do that. Like, I went in, I did a point in time restore, no problems. It was a great test. But let's talk about this new data model, and then we can talk about the challenges I've been having, and there might be some people in here who have good ideas, or they listen to it later on and tell us we're idiots. But if you think about this relationship of 5.5 billion email addresses, 13 billion instances of the email addresses being in a breach, you've really sort of got two entities in a mapping table. You've got the data breach itself, you've got the email address, and then you've got a many-to-many relationship between them. My email address has been in many breaches. The Dropbox data breach has got many email addresses. So we end up with these three tables, two of which need to be populated on every breach load, one being the email addresses, one being the mapping of the email addresses to the data breaches. Now, if we take a completely traditional RDBMS design approach to this, and we say, okay, email address. The email address really is unique, isn't it? You know, you should never have the same email address in there twice. The reason we have the mapping table is so that we can create multiple instances of the same thing against some other entity, being the breach. So we have a unique constraint for the email address. Likewise, the email address can only ever be in the one data breach once. I can't appear twice in the Dropbox data breach. So we have a unique constraint there too. Now, for those of you who live in database land, you're probably already starting to see where the problem's going to be here, but we end up with a 5.5 billion record table with the unique constraint and a 13 billion record table with the unique constraint. And then we load a new data breach like this Russian one yesterday, 3.8 million records. So got 3.8 million email addresses in that breach. What do we have to do? Well, first of all, we have to figure out which of those email addresses have not been seen before. Now, I'm going to go and look at some of my stats here. So, roughly speaking, I think Stephanie said it was about 900,000 of the 3.8 million addresses hadn't been seen before. Now, it doesn't take us very long to figure that out because we've got good indexes on all these tables. But now we need to take 900,000 email addresses and put them into a table with 5.5 billion records and a unique constraint. So every one of those 900,000 email addresses needs to not exist in there already, otherwise the script's going to fail. That lookup, this is a theory, that lookup process is extraordinarily expensive and time consuming. To the point where when we did this yesterday, and I inserted roughly 900,000 email addresses, it took 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 44 seconds. And this is for a breach, which is only 3.8 million records. We have breaches, which are 700 million records. We have lots of breaches, which are tens of millions of records. Now, this was on the smallest possible instance of the SQL Server, but even toying around with this earlier on, so we did a 20 million record breach, and that was Cutout Pro. 20 million records on the largest possible instance of a SQL Server took 5 hours. We can't have a 5 hour load for 20 million records. Because what happens when it's 200 million records? There are many 200 million plus records in there. In fact, the 10th largest breach is 268 million records. So we can't have this situation. And then inserting into the mapping table, so the mapping table that maps email address to breach with the 13 billion odd records that sit in there and a unique constraint on the email address ID and the breach ID, we put 3.8 million records in there yesterday. It took 1 hour and 5 minutes. Now, when we actually did it with 20 million records with the database on the largest possible scale, it took 1 hour and 20 minutes. So I guess bigger databases run faster, or more well-resourced databases run faster. But this is killing us. And the message I sent Stefan just before is it took 2 hours and 20 minutes to go through the entire load process, and like 2 hours and 8 minutes was just inserting into tables. Now, in case you're wondering, well, are you doing all these fancy joins and things before you do the insert? Because maybe it's the select, which is the expensive thing. It's not. We're literally just selecting out of one table because we do a bunch of pre-processing, inserting into another table, and there's our time. So, and Stefan, jump in here if I've missed anything of pertinence. Our theory and my thinking as of 3-something this morning when I was laying awake thinking about it is that we just kill the unique keys. We kill the unique constraints. And part of the reason for that, well, I mean, the obvious reason is that that seems to be where our bottleneck is, and we need to probably spend a bit more time looking at query execution plans and so on. However, it really can't be anything else. So part of the thinking is that's obviously where the bottleneck is. I feel like those times should be 95% less than what they are. The other part of the thinking is if we control the pipeline, so we control the way data goes in there, this is nothing that randos on the internet can submit to. There's literally a data breach pipeline. We're the only ones that control that, so we can control data integrity. So long as we do everything upstream right, you should never have a duplicate record anyway. However, if you do have a duplicate record, what happens? Not really anything. And all of the queries that hit that table, we can always put a distinct on anyway. I just realized when I was like half asleep this morning, was I saying unique? I meant distinct. So if we go through and we just chuck a distinct, and the only data we're selecting out of here as well, we're not returning things like the ID. So let's imagine my email address goes in twice and I end up with two primary key IDs on it, which are completely different. And then we do a distinct across that column as well. We're going to have two records. But the only thing we're selecting when you query, say, by an email address is the ID of the breaches. So if we pull that back as a distinct, it doesn't matter if I'm in there, my email address is in there twice against the same breach. We're only going to get this one value back. So that's our thinking at the moment. And I think if we do that, we can actually simplify a whole bunch of the other queries that I'm looking at at the moment, a whole bunch of other processing. This is kind of a not fun thing to do, because a lot of what we've been doing, things like creating indexes, in some cases, some of these indexes we've created have taken days to create the index because the data is so large. And I've been spinning this SQL up as large as possible to the point where it's really starting to sting just looking at my cost analysis on Azure. And we've been winging it a little bit. And I think that where we're getting to now is that you reach a certain scale, which I suspect we've well and truly surpassed, where all of the traditional structure of a database very often doesn't make as much sense. Now, Stefan's just said, we can also have a single proc that runs regularly checking for duplicates and fixes them, deleting one and merging the data. As a just-in-case scenario, you know, I was thinking about that as well. My concern with that is I reckon that is going to be really, really expensive, because let's say it is on the email address breach table. I think we call it breached email breach. You're literally saying you're going to have to do a group by on those two columns, having count star greater than one across 13 odd billion. It's really, really expensive. I bet you that query is going to be a nightmare. So I have a bit of a feeling that that's something that we might run once in a blue moon when there's reason to, because I think if we can chuck a distinct on the selects that pull, whether it's everything from the email address search, the k-anonymity search, the domain search, I think that distinct actually solves all the problems. And I don't think that distinct is going to be expensive when there's a very small number of records returned anyway. Because even if you have an email address and you join it on the breached the breach ID as well, the average email address is in two breaches. So you're returning two records. Doing a distinct on that shouldn't matter. Alistair says, email breaches merging, other email breaches, more rows per email address and cleaned up sometime. Email breaches merging other email breaches will make a big job to merge one row when you do find a dupe. Yeah, I think we're really going to be on demand for that, simply because the likelihood of having duplicates is low when we control the pipeline. And maybe we even just wrap a lot of this code we've got at the moment, Stefan, in the one transaction that can roll back if things go pear-shaped. So the likelihood is low. The impact is low because we can distinct it out anyway, because we're never talking about data corruption. It's not an integrity discussion. It's a redundancy discussion, and that there might be some duplicates in there. Marek says, query execution plans have always been super useful. What have had to do with databases in the past? Well worth checking those. Yeah, and that is one of the discussions we had. In fact, I think, Stefan, I almost need to find like two other, let's call them classic data breaches today. And the first one, and we might just run everything as it was before, turn on the query execution plans, make sure that we get some meaningful output from that. I just feel like I'm 90% sure it's going to tell us what we already know anyway. And assuming it does, then we can always just drop those indexes and then do another data breach and go, okay, well, you know, how fast does it go now? I think we can do that. Yeah. All right, I'll find some more breaches. But my worry is that we need to get this right before the next like multiple tens, let alone hundreds of millions of row data breach turns up. And then we're like, ah, crap, like how am I going to load this now? Now, eventually we'll get to the point, like we can run these two things together, right? Like we can run the old table storage together with the new SQL Azure. And so long as we're inserting data into each, we can just have all of our sort of real-time queries and everything hitting the old table storage stuff. We can run them together for months if we want to do that, until we get to the point where we're like 100% happy with this. And then eventually the goal is just to roll over all the queries. Steph and I had a really good idea. We both had the same wonderful idea about how to optimize that and take a lot of load off the database with that caching thing with the k-anonymity, Stefan. And then eventually we'll just be able to delete table storage and there'll be 5.5 billion table storage records that disappear. So Marek says, is there ever any lack of breaches? I know. James, dear hackers, please submit your small breaches for testing. It has been handy because, you know, the WattLabs one, that's 22,000 records. So when that popped up, I was like, well, that's convenient, you know, because 22,000 records, like how bad can it be? Now, just for interest's sake, yeah, going back through these same durations here. So with the 3.8 million records, when we inserted those new breached emails, email addresses, it took an hour and 2 minutes. For 22,000 records, it took only 44 seconds. Obviously very, very small, but it gives us, I wonder how much pro rata does that work out? Because if we were to look at, where are we there? 3.8 million, divided by, what was that, 22,000? All right, so you've got a breach that's 172 times larger than the other. Like, does this scale, 44 times 172 equals divided by 60 for the minutes, 126 minutes, that's 2 hours. Nah, roughly. On a per record basis, it actually took twice as long to do the 22,000 record breaches of 3.8 million. Anyway, 44 seconds. When we inserted into the mapping table, it was an hour and 5 minutes for the 3.8 million records, and it was 52 seconds for the 22,000 records. So part of the problem when it's only 22,000 records as well is you're like, 52 seconds, it's not too bad, but will that increase in a linear fashion with the number of records or not? And there's a whole dark art to SQL Server stuff. It's a dark art to it. It's not always entirely predictable. It's in a live database that's got other stuff going on with it as well. Are we testing in production? Like maybe a little bit. But I think they're very well thought out tests. All right, last thing I was going to talk about, and I mentioned this last week as well. We do have a GitHub repo, which is just for the Have I Been Pwned UX stuff. So we've got a UX rebuild repository in Have I Been Pwned account. Bunch of discussions going on there at the moment. Style guide, website taxonomy, data visualization, client-side tech stack, website visual design, modernizing the logo. I think I mentioned last week, Neil Caldwell has contributed a lot there, which has been good. I'm going to write about it and invite more people to start contributing shortly. That might be something I do after I get back from Japan, because I'm just conscious that every time you start inviting input, it consumes cycles to then process the input and respond and engage. But that is there. Stefan says, I think we can delete the foreign keys on the mapping table. I think those are slowing us down there as well. Well, the primary key obviously does slow us down, but it's pretty much required for lookup regardless. Well, but we don't have that the primary key on the mapping table is a composite key anyway, which is the one that is the unique index, which I think we need to actually have a look at what changes we're going to make to this before we do that. I might ping you when I get off this call, actually, because whatever we dropping indexes, I don't really care too much about, but if we have to recreate stuff on a 13 billion row table, we're going to be scaling the database up to max and then running it for days and days again as well. Dropping the foreign key is an interesting one. You kind of lose that referential integrity, but then we control the pipeline anyway. But it could also be something that we do in phases, right? So maybe what we do is we drop that unique constraint, run again. How does that look? And then do we drop the foreign key? But I guess the foreign key on every record insert needs to validate that the ID being inserted into there does exist in the other table. I know, there's a little bit of a dirty feeling about it, where it's like you're throwing out some of the wonderful things about an RDBMS because an RDBMS is too slow, but we're literally going to an RDBMS for other things. I don't know, mate. Let's take it up offline. I'll have a chat to you on the messenger after this. Marek says, care to drop the GitHub repo link in here? Yes, I would care to. No problems at all. So, in fact, what I'll do, I'll drop the home page because that explains that logic, Marek. And as I sort of explain here on the, for this back on UX rebuild stuff, the thinking here is that, have I been pwned? Started as something very simple. It's really remained very, very similar for a decade. Certainly UX-wise it has, more than a decade now. And there's just a bunch that needs a rejig. But go and have a look at the discussions in there. I'm using GitHub discussions for this just because we're in this like divergence phase, like everyone's just got lots of ideas. Let's just chuck them in there, chat about them, see what sort of starts to stick, and then we can work out where we go from there. Okay, folks, I'm going to wrap it up there because I'm going to go and chat to you, Stefan, about keys and all sorts of boring databasey stuff. And then I'm going to come to you next week from Tokyo. Cheers, folks.